maybe it'll be published in the States, although the issues will be cleared with the congregation, with the clergy, each time. In my meeting, as I think I told you, with Cardinal Sanchez in Rome, made it very clear he does want his magazine to promote the English speaking world with information on the Catechism, and they promised us in Rome that the Vatican would provide us with the information that could be put into the magazine. We're planning on at least a 40-page first edition. And the important thing, of course, is to make sure that we have not just a publication, but have the people not just even subscribing to it, but using it. And this is where I was in conversation with Jim Lacoutis of Catholic United for the Faith in Doraville last month. And the hope is that certain lay Catholic organizations in the country will work with us to promote what I think we call the Catholic Catechist Association for the English-speaking countries. That would be England, Scotland, of course, Ireland, and much of India, at least the educated part of India, and the same for the educated part of Africa. Now, I did not think I should say much more until we got the thing really underway and know specifically what needs to be done. By next year, however, I will have a more definite program available for all of us to be involved in, because we do want to come out every month. Then the Eucharistic Crusade. I think I told you, my general, my father general, this is 4 years ago, he told me that he wants the Eucharistic Crusade restored in the United States. The Eucharistic Crusade is the children's counterpart of the Apostleship of Prayer, concentrating on three aspects of our faith. Instruction, religious instruction, or catechetics. Secondly, devotion to the Holy Eucharist and devotion to the Sacred Heart as really present in the Holy Eucharist. And then thirdly, devotion to Our Lady. In order to get the thing moving, as I was told in Rome, the Society of Jesus, for generations now, has been in the role of encouraging, promoting, informing, motivating bishops to engage in here the Eucharistic Crusade for children, 6 to 18. And because I was told in Rome to find a benevolent bishop, I believe I told you that Bishop Timlin agreed to write to his fellow bishops, which he did. I spoke to him yesterday and again today, to the bishop, Bishop Timlin. You might just set this date aside. You can possibly come to Scranton, Pennsylvania, on Saturday, the 15th of October, which is the Feast of Teresa of Avila, 16th, which is Sunday, is the liturgical feast of St. Margaret Mary. In any case, Bishop Timlin wrote to the Bishop of the United States, and as of this morning, he got 20 dioceses signed up. In 30 years, the Eucharistic Crusade had just died out. So we're stirring the dead embers and bring it back to life. Well, there's, needless to say, a lot of work to be done. We're having a meeting in Scranton, Pennsylvania, the O'Connells are coming up from Washington, John and Dolores. A Father Herbert Smith, a Jesuit from St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia, is coming in from Philadelphia. And I'm coming in from Detroit. We're meeting in the morning of next Tuesday, a meeting in Scranton, Pennsylvania, with a bishop. In the afternoon, we're meeting with a priest who he has appointed to oversee the promotion of the Eucharistic Crusade in the Diocese of Scranton. Now, our office, as of now, will be in Washington, D.C. We've already received a substantial donation towards the buying, printing, and so on of material for children, because that's what the Eucharistic Crusade is all about. In any case, after the meeting next Tuesday, so I'll be back then Wednesday from the meeting with the bishop in Scranton, Pennsylvania, I can be much more specific. And those are the two principal apostolates, if I can so speak, that I see the Marian Nation catechists becoming somehow involved in the next year. The catechetical for the English speaking world, organizing a Catholic Catechist Association and having its own domestic organ to be called the Catholic Catechist, and then the Eucharistic Crusade, which has breathtaking potential, because the Eucharistic Crusade closed, shut down 30 years ago in the 60s. Many reasons, most of which, of course, are common knowledge, secularization of our nation. In any case, thought I'd share that with you. And then, many of you wonder, what are we going to do? Have no fear. In fact, you might be sorry that you asked, what are we going to do? There's plenty to do. So much for the two announcements that I wish to make. Now, you should be getting, Bill, at least a few pages. Thank you. It was questions 15. Pardon me. I was told by Marion at 24.
24.
Oh. If you find the rest of this, I'd appreciate it.
Let me see.
No, anyway, can I have one of those, please? Yeah.
Okay. You want a black copy or will the blue one work?
That's fine. In general, I would like to write as much material as we can cover in a given class on, you know, what we're talking about, scholastic philosophy, and we're concentrating on the first course in scholastic philosophy, which is metaphysics. And consequently, I would like to now continue with question 25, but I think I mentioned last time, I would very much appreciate, thank you, questions from you people, and ideally in writing, partly because of my hearing, and also writing synthesized in the thoughts. You got some questions?
I've got some empty cards for people to fill out.
Is it just one, or you have, are those blanks?
Blanks, yeah.
Thanks. Let me pass them around. Although over the last few classes, I've done everything I could to impress you with the importance of scholastic philosophy. I believe the single main reason for the breakdown of the faith in millions of minds, and in many countries, especially the academically educated countries, is not being trained, minds not being trained in scholastic philosophy. Question 25, therefore. What is the principle of contradiction? What is the principle of contradiction? What you can do, by the way, after maybe half an hour or so, if you have questions in the meantime, I'd be happy to answer them, because this material, I assure you, is not obvious. What is the principle of contradiction? Answer. It is the first law of being, which holds that a thing cannot be and not be at the same time in the same respect. It is the first law of being, which holds that a thing cannot be and not be at the same time in the same respect. You might ask, what could be more obvious? Does any sane person deny the principle of contradiction? As you'll see before this presentation is over, the dominant philosophy in the Western world denies the principle of contradiction. In all the pious rhetoric, or the memorizing of scripture, unless the mind is itself trained in the laws of the mind, and the faith is at the mercy, obviously, of the intellect. Question 26. Why is this the first law of being? Because on it depends every other law of being. If the principle of contradiction were not true, then we would not be certain about anything. In fact, we could not know any truth about anything, or any truth about any being. Why is this first law of being? Why is this the first law of being? Principle of contradiction. Because on it depends every other law of being. If the principle of contradiction were not true, then we would not be certain about anything. In fact, we could not know any truth about any being. 27. Why has the principle of contradiction been enunciated? Why have such a principle as a principle of contradiction? Historically, because of two devastating errors that have penetrated human philosophy. The teaching of Heraclitus among the ancient Greeks and of Hegel in modern times. Question, why has the principle of contradiction been enunciated? Historically, because of two devastating errors that have penetrated human philosophy. The teaching of Heraclitus, Heraclitus, Heraclitus among the ancient Greeks, and of Hegel, Hegel, in modern times. Now, what about each? Heraclitus, Greek philosopher, 540 to 470 B.C. 540 to 470 B.C., whom Aristotle refuted for his doctrine that all things are constantly passing into their opposites. Heraclitus, Greek philosopher, 540 to 470, Remember, Aristotle refuted for his doctrine that all things are constantly passing into their opposites. Then, Georg Hegel. That's George minus an E. Georg Hegel. Dates 1770 to 1831. Come. The German philosopher who claimed that, quote, reality, unquote, who claimed that reality is the universal coexistence of oppositions. The universal coexistence of oppositions. Better, of opposites. There was a coexistence of opposites, comma, which are being absorbed in a higher unity, from which in turn new oppositions generate. So Georg Hegel, the German philosopher who claimed that reality, unquote, is universal coexistence of opposites, which are being absorbed in a higher unity, from which in turn new oppositions generate, period. Marxism is built on Hegelianism. The dominant philosophy in American University is Hegel. What is the second law of being? Remember, we said the first law of being was the principle of contradiction. What is the second law of being? It is the principle of the excluded middle. The principle of the excluded middle. Since being and nothing are directly opposed and contradictory, there is no alternative between the two. Period. One or the other must always be true of everything. In other words, a thing must either be or not be, which I put in quotation marks. In other words, comma, a thing must either be or not be, unquote. Or open quotes, or open quotes, everything either is or is not, unquote. Let me spend a few minutes on this. Over the years in teaching, the theology of creation. It is an article of faith that God created the world out of nothing, by which we mean that God began with nothing, He parted with nothing, He gained nothing. And that behind creation is the almighty, loving will of God. And the two words are crucial. The almighty, loving will of God. Almighty. Because God can bring into being what did not exist. That is a basic definition of omnipotence. The power of bringing into being what did not exist. And it is on this level that modern philosophy, and oh, by the way, all, I want to repeat another line, all, goes back to the rise of the so-called Protestant Reformation. All of it. All modern philosophy in the Western world goes back to the rise of what they still call, and the English, people speaking English are so accustomed, they never think twice. You just speak of Reformation this and Reformation that. Absolutely, utterly, unqualified, that is not the truth. The Reformation reformed nothing. It destroyed the foundation of Christianity, as we're seeing, and destroyed even the foundations of sound rational thinking, and brought back the irrational thinking of those pre-Christian philosophers, like, for example, Heraclitus. In any case, and this is where men like Hegel, who is so important for understanding both modern philosophy and understanding the errors that have penetrated Catholic thinking. You don't begin to understand a man like, even an amateur, like Hans Kuhn, and he is an amateur, or a professional, like Karl Rahner. Both deeply, profoundly influenced by Hegel. And the reason is because Hegel, not really new, that's N-E-W, what he brought back was what the non-Christian world had held among the pre-Christian philosophers, for example, Heraclitus. And behind their thinking in pre-Christian times, and behind the thinking of those today, like a Karl Rahner, who has done immense damage to the church in our day. Behind their thinking is, to put it mildly, a tampering with divine omnipotence. That something comes from nothing. Nothing develops. The word evolution is almost a sacred word in the modern world, and the most disastrous form of evolution is the evolution of everything, including the being we call God. As I think I've said, at least to some of you, the largest English-speaking publisher in the world for process theology, which is a contradiction in terms, claiming that God himself is part of that evolutionary process. He too began as nothing. It's nothing. You get the logic. Well, for men like Karl Rahner and others, this evolutionary process goes to the very heart of being. And of course, on the premises of this either evolutionary philosophy or process theology, that there's nothing left. And I mean, nothing is left of our faith. Nothing. The one. Number 29. How important is this principle? Remember, that's the principle of the astuted middle. There is no middle ground between being and non-being. But you see, behind the principle of suited middle, am I making sense, is the fact that there has to be infinite being to bring, well, other beings into existence. And bring them into existence out of nothing. But notice, there has to be infinite omnipotent being who, well, does the creation, who does the production. 29. How important is this principle of the excluded middle? Most important, because so much present-day thinking ignores the principle of contradiction, or the corollary principle of the excluded middle. I don't want to lose anybody because we're dealing with automates here. Am I making sense? Now, nothing that we can casually talk about. Those of us who have the faith, nothing we believe is exactly that. It is nothing, non-existent being. And what does not exist cannot evolve. And that's bedrock Hegel. Bedrock Hegel. I don't think I finished the sentence, and I want to identify the largest process theology or evolutionary philosophy. English publisher in the English speaking world is Apollos Press in New Jersey. I repeat, the largest, the most extreme, the most devastating. There's nothing more extreme in any language, in any philosophy, than to claim that from nothing comes something. Otherwise, then we who have the faith hold that there must be an infinite almighty being, namely God, who can produce being, created being indeed, as we casually say, out of nothing. It's not that he uses the nothing, but he produces something where there was nothing. And this self-evolving, this process, where God himself is in process, the leading, at least for me, the leading process theologian, which is a contradiction in terms, process theologian. If God is in process, he's not God. There's no theos, no God. Was my confrere at the Lutheran School of Theology for 7 years. And we knew each other. Hours, scores of hours, 7 years of conversation. And his publisher was Apollos Press. These things, unless we know this, we may wonder, gosh, why does the Pope do something? My friends, I tell you, you've got no idea how deep and how widespread the errors that are making the modern world really are. And they're in high places. Are there any questions? No, please not. Write them down, please. Are there modern philosophers, theologians, you recommend reading? Yes, there are, but I think rather than just off the cuff, Peter Kreefe, of course, would be one. But let me take this with me, and somebody, it would remind me by next week, maybe Monday or so, call up the office to remind me to get some names together, okay? What do you think of Gilson, Desjardins, and Lubeck? Yeah? Those three, obviously, are in three different categories. Among the three, Gilson is authentic. I can recommend Gilson without hesitation, both as philosopher and as theologian. He has written extensively, much in French, but also extensively in English. Chardin, as you know, was a Jesuit, died in 1955, and when I lived in New York, I was a member of the Jesuit community where he belonged. Chardin was a French Jesuit, had a great love for anthropology. His first published book, Denied Original Sin. The Pope condemned his book, and he was forbidden to publish that Chardin. So, but as a disobedient Jesuit, a genius in disobedience, Chardin. He wrote a library, spent some 30 years writing books, and transferred the ownership of his manuscripts to a woman in Paris. Jesuits, no control over those manuscripts. And by now, I'm sure millions of dollars have been earned from those manuscripts. Everything that Chardin had in mind already, as a young priest, when he did the original sin, he just poured out into his books. His best known book is The Phenomenon of Man. Always I read Chardin, quoted him, and when they came out, or was coming out, with the County Lifetime Reading Plan, the double the editor of the manuscript, he said, "Father, could you put a man like Chardin in? Gosh, this is a County Lifetime Reading Plan." Well, I protect myself by having a contract before I write. So, it's funny, Bob. He's not part of my contract. But can't you put him in anyhow? So, what I did, and if somebody would remind me, I have the short chapter on Chardin, which I wrote for Doubleday, but of course never published, just what happened. Before the Lifetime Reading Plan was published, the editor of Doubleday got another job. He left Doubleday. Was I relieved? In any case, Chardin was a Hegelian. Chardin had bought Hegel. Am I clear? Then to Lubeck. To Lubeck, another Jesuit, went through three stages. Stage number one, he too had been bitten by the Hegelian bug, and there was, he wrote when he was condemned by the church, was the real distinction between the natural and the supernatural order. He was condemned, his book was forbidden, then he was converted. So he spent the rest of his life defending the faith. And before he died, the Pope made him cardinal. But he lost most of his friends. He was a cardinal, but was he a friendless cardinal? Has to do that. Please explain modern realism again. Are we saying that this is a false realism? Well, it must be my language, my pronunciation. The word is not modern, modern. It is, remember, what's the right word?
Moderate.
What?
Moderate.
Moderate. Moderate realism. What moderates the realism? In other words, behold, there's a reality outside the mind. In other words, reality is not reality, quotes, is not merely a projection of our thoughts. That would be, we call it idealism. But rather, and also, it is not as though there were things outside the mind that we could never know. That's Immanuel Kant. That's Kantian philosophy. You can never penetrate into the essence of anything. Of anything. All you can know is the external phenomena. Sense experience. You never get inside of anything. That's Kantianism. So moderate realism, language is a little strange, means we do believe there's a real world outside the mind. But we don't say that that real world is just a projection of the mind, number one, nor that the real world can be known by the mind. Two extremes. Hence the word moderate. But as in every case, you've got to explain your terms. Is there another question, or did I miss something? Shall we continue? How are we doing time-wise?
10 to 8.
Please?
Almost 5 to 8.
5 to 8, okay. My plan then is to be in time for starting Mass at 8:30, okay? Question 30. Is there unity in being? Is there unity in being? Let me tell you, these are bread and butter in metaphysics. Yes, there is logical unity in being. The logos refers to the mind. There is logical unity in being. Period. Our minds arrive at a unified concept of being. Our minds arrive at a unified concept of being. We see all being as real and the opposite of non-being. At the same time, we know that objectively there are many different kinds of being. Repeat. Is there unity in being? Yes. There is a logical unity in being. Our minds arrive at a unified concept of being. We see all being as real and the opposite of non-being. At the same time, we know that objectively there are many different kinds of being. Our minds provide unity among the different kinds of being. 31. What are the two basic concepts we have of being? What are the two basic concepts we have of being? They are univocal and analogous. They are univocal and analogous. And now we get into what is indispensable for knowing our faith. Question again, what are the two basic concepts we have of being? The two basic concepts are univocal and analogous. So, next question, what is a univocal concept of being? A univocal concept is one that is understood and applied to many beings in entirely the same sense. Thus, we can speak of a living being, unquote, universally, whether the being is a man, an animal, or a plant. So univocal means the concept, the idea is univocal. Because we use the term, in this case, say, living being, in the same sense. In other words, there is a basic similarity among human beings, animals, and plants as living beings. Of course, there are many differences, but that's not our purpose here. There is a basic similarity or unity. That's univocal. Another big one. What is an analogous concept of being? What is an analogous concept of being? And just for the record, analogous is spelled A-N-A-L-A-G-O-U-S, three A's, analogous concept of being. Answer. An analogous concept of being is applied to different beings in a similar but not identical way. An analogous concept of being is applied to different beings in a similar but not identical way. Period. Analogy means resemblance without identity. Analogy means resemblance without identity. Period. It is imperfect likeness between two or more beings that are compared with each other. It is imperfect likeness between two or more beings that are compared with each other. Period. Thus we may say that someone has a warm personality. Comparing that person's character to the comfort we get from the warmth of a heater in cold weather. Clearly, the personality of an individual is not a heater, it's not a stove, it's not a furnace, but there is a similarity between the experience of being warmed, say in cold weather, by a heater, and what a personality that we call a warm personality does to our spirit. And in general, analogies are taken from bodily things and apply to spiritual things. Not only, but especially. Next question, and it's the big one. How important are analogous concepts of being in understanding our Christian faith? How important are analogous concepts of being in understanding our Christian faith? Answer. Indispensably necessary. The revealed mysteries of our faith can never be comprehended, that is, fully understood by any created mind. The real mysteries of our faith can never be comprehended, that is, fully understood by any created mind. Yet, we are to understand what we believe and grow in this understanding. The main purpose, by the way, of Catholic education. How do you understand? Answer. Through prayer and the grace of God, of course. Through prayer and the grace of God, of course. But what kind of knowledge can we have of such mysteries as the Holy Trinity, the Incarnation, and the life of grace? We get this understanding or knowledge, I repeat, through prayer and the grace of God. But then, What kind of knowledge is it? It is all analogous knowledge. Under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, as revealed in sacred scripture and sacred tradition, we arrive at some understanding of the mysteries through the principle of analogy. For example, we compare divine grace with the natural life we experience on earth. Would anybody remember, and